black and white and red all over, Ian Murta. He can talk football all day.
I remember a few years ago checking into a hotel abroad. I can't remember where it was, but then sifting through my emails, finding an official announcement from Newcastle United saying that St. James's Park was going to be renamed the Sports Direct Arena. I was absolutely outraged. So were Newcastle fans in their thousands, justifiably so. Now, forgive me, but England fans being outraged by a little motif on the back of the collar, it's not the same. Okay, they've changed. If it was the strip, I could understand people being annoyed, people being angry, but it's not. I mean, England under 21s play today. If you don't like it, do what Harvey Elliott did and turn up your collar. This isn't the same as changing a stadium name, changing nickname of a club. What do you think, David? Obviously, I wasn't brought up an England fan, but are you angry? Are you outraged?
I'm not happy. I'm not angry and outraged. I think they're trying to go all. What would it be? What's creative, modern, fresh, new design?
As long as you don't use that word woke, because I'm not having it.
No, that doesn't qualify for woke in my book. Lots of other things do. I don't like it. I mean, the back of that shirt collar should be the cross of St. George. I would want to be looking at that red cross on a white background. I mean, that's just me.
Dave, who looks at the back of a collar? As I said, we're not talking about a badge. We're not talking about a strip. Who looks at the back of a collar?
Probably not many people, but if you're going to be flogging them at 120 quid a shirt, then, you know, as a fan, I'd look
now
at that.
That is
and
something
think,
to be outraged about the price. I'll agree with you there.
Yeah.
But listen, Dave, anyway.
Look, it's not a huge thing. I mean, it's not a huge thing.
Yeah.
Just from a personal perspective and a preference, I would rather see the cross of St. George on there. It's been there in the past. There's a cross there now, but it looks nothing like the flag of England. I'd bounce it back to you, Ian. I mean, if it was going to be the Republic of Ireland shirt and that well-known flag is on the back of the collar, how would you feel if they changed it?
Again, if it was the back of the collar, I'd find it almost irrelevant, Dave, to be honest. If it was the badge, if it was changing the strip, then yes, I think you'd have a point, but as I say, we're talking about something which is about 3 centimetres in width on the back of a collar, which can be turned up. But listen, anyway, we've been very contemporaneous, haven't we? This is a show that focuses mainly on the 3 Northeast clubs, but they're having a rest this weekend. It's international weekend. So that's what we've opened our show with, haven't we? Now, my second guest tonight is someone everyone will know, but they won't have heard his voice, his very distinctive voice, for many, many years. It's former Newcastle commentator Mick Lowes, who, quite a legend, he was hugely popular with Newcastle fans who couldn't make it to the match and would be listening to him. And I spoke to him earlier today. I couldn't believe it's almost 8 years since... Since he packed in, he did it for over 25 years for various stations, so it'd be lovely to catch up with Mick. But my first guest, and again, this is combining the international theme with all 3 clubs, it's my good friend Damien Spellman of the Press Association, who's been covering North East football almost as long as me. But he's not just been doing Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough games, for about the last 15 years, he's been covering the Republic of Ireland for the Press Association. So here's Damien Spellman. Well, Damien, for a lot of football journalists, the international break, it's a time to take a well-earned breather, possibly a few days off. But that's not been the case with you for about 15 years, has it, as the Press Association's Republic of Ireland correspondent?
That's right. No, absolutely. You're right. We used to get a few days off back in the days, but I know you've done your international football as well. And the other lads are heading for the beaches, we're heading for the far-flung corners of the globe and putting in some graft.
That's right. I remember I had 3 years. Obviously, I did Republic of Ireland intermittently, and then I had 3 years on the England beat. And, of course, when you're covering the national team, you're writing full spreads, you're writing for the back pages, you're nipping down, St. George's Park in Staffordshire is a long, long journey, three and a half hours each way. So I used to come back and report back for club duty, pretty shattered, like your good self, who could be all over Europe, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, people think it's a bit of a jolly, and it's fantastic. You know, you visit some places you would never dream of going, you know, in any other form, not for a holiday or something like that. But there can be 10, 12, 14, 16-hour days, you know. You're sort of at the whim of the schedule, and obviously travel, as you get to our venerable age, and travel does take it out of you.
It certainly does. But the Republic of Ireland job, it's probably changed over the years, especially for a Northeast writer. You know, back in the day, they had a better-than-evens chance of reaching a major tournament. And, of course, some of their key players was from our clubs, Shay Given, Niall Quinn, Kevin Kilbarnon. It's not quite the same now, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, Ireland, I suppose, in our lifetime, have had two golden generations almost, you know, the one where sort of the back end of Liam Brady, and then the Ray Houghtons and the Aldridges and that generation, and then the one which we would be more closely associated with as you say, the Shay Givens and the Robbie Keanes and the Roy Keane before him, and Damien Duff and people like that. And yeah, they were a very competitive team. But even in my time, in my 16 years now, they've qualified for two tournaments and narrowly missed out on another one. But yeah, it's looking harder now. They're sort of blooding a new generation, but have been for about 4 years. And sadly, that hasn't equated to the results you need to sort of actually show the progression you think you're making. Yeah.
That's right. Those of us with Irish affiliations will just have to make do with having the rugby team as the best in the world, Damien.
we'll talk about that privately, Ian.
let's turn to the clubs, and obviously you're watching a lot of Newcastle. Eddie Howe. Now, there is some debate, with inverted commas around the word some, about his future. I know that you, like me, think he's done a very good job, and really, he is the man to take them forward. But am I right in thinking that whatever soundings come from the corridors of power at St. James's Park, that doesn't matter? There's only one man who counts, and that's probably not even the chairman, Al Ramayan. It's probably the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed Salman. If he wants Eddie Howe to stay, he will stay. If he doesn't, he will go.
I think there's certainly an element of truth in that. You know, the days when Freddie Shepherd, or before him Sir John Hall, sort of called the shots are probably long gone. And yeah, that decision, you would suspect, wouldn't necessarily be made in the boardroom at St. James's Park. I do agree with you that I think, you know, Howe has done a pretty good job, and this season has been hideous for many reasons. But I think the caveat has got to be they spectacularly overachieved last season. You know, what they did was ridiculous from where they were. And this season was always going to be less successful. Now, the degree to which it's been less successful so far, I suppose you'd have to say, is, you know, perhaps the disappointment. But I think, you know, when people were asking me in the summer where I thought, what I thought would be a good season for Newcastle, I've got to be honest, I thought to finish in the top eight would have been a good season. Now, that's possible for them to do it. Whether it's plausible is another thing, particularly given the news on Sven Botman last night.
Yes.
But I always, you know, they were never going to repeat last season. That so much went right for them last season in terms of what they did on the pitch, but also the fact that Liverpool and Chelsea and Tottenham were weaker, and certainly Liverpool and Tottenham have been a lot stronger this season. So it was always going to be more of a challenge.
I think you've nailed it there, Damien. I was asked back in September, you know, where will Newcastle finish? And I said there will be a couple of very, very good sides who will finish 8th and 9th in the table, because, you know, Brighton and West Ham were going nowhere. They're still decent sides. And, of course, we all knew that Liverpool, Tottenham, possibly Chelsea would do a lot better than last season. And, you know, yes, Newcastle aren't even 9th, they're 10th, and that there's a lot of reasons for that. They massively overachieved, the injuries. But have there been anyhow mistakes, Damien? The one that I pointed out earlier in the season was the Liverpool game at St James's Park, where Newcastle were cruising to victory, and then I think there were some foolhardy substitutions, and of course Darwin Nunez got 2 late goals. And I think those substitutions they made Eddie a little bit more cautious when changing the side late on in the game, and I thought that shaped the first half of the season, if not the second.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one area that, well, not the one area, but the area where I think Eddie Howe is open to criticism is the substitution. The game that sticks out for me, and I accept what you're saying about the Liverpool game in particular, the game that sticks out for me was the away game in Paris, where I don't think he made any substitutions at a time when Alexander Isak, I seem to remember at one point, was standing on the halfway line because he literally could not run another step. And there were people on the bench, admittedly, there were young kids, there were Ben Parkinson and people like that, who, you know, wouldn't have had the experience to be thrown into a game like that particularly, but he might have run around and occupied defenders a bit more than Isak, who was just on his way back from injury, was able to at that point. I think there are areas in which the manager and his staff can be criticised, but I think there's still a lot of, you know, a lot of the foundation they put in is still there. And I think this season a lot of the tactical tweaks just at times just haven't worked, and it's a very fine balance. And, you know, particularly that situation in the midfield, where suddenly that midfield three has become very porous, where it wasn't last season at all. I know there was a different makeup, and Joe Linton was a key part of that. But it's, I think there is room for valid criticism of the manager. Of course, there is, and all managers, you know, even Pep Guardiola gets criticised at times, not very often, but
not very often, Joe.
No, absolutely. So I think that's a valid point.
Talking of the midfield and talking about criticism, where do you stand in the Sean Longstaff debate? Because I find it ironic. Earlier in the season, when particularly when they lost at Brighton, and Tonali hadn't maintained the standards he set on his debut against Aston Villa, a lot of fans were saying, and I was saying, and I'm sure you were, the side is missing the industry, the endeavour of Sean Longstaff. And yet now Tonali is suspended. Tonali is becoming a better and better player in his absence. And Sean Longstaff is coming in for quite a lot of criticism, along with a fellow Geordie, Dan Byrne.
No, I think that's true. And I think quite often the players become better in their absence, don't they? Unlike Jamal Lascelles, who actually literally did become a better player in his absence. That was remarkable. I think, you know, the midfield isn't quite ticking at the moment the way it did, and because of that, I think, you know, Sean Longstaff in particular has suffered, because he's having, you know, there's an element where there's a consciousness that they have to try and tighten that up, which is curbing his instincts to get forward and do what he did so well last season. Sean Longstaff isn't the destroyer that Joe Linton is in that way. He's a different type of player. But I think there's also an element as well. It's always a bit easier to have a go at a homegrown player who's cost the club nothing. That always seems to be the case, whether that's conscious or not. I think the Dan Byrne situation is different. And You know, I think the problem with Dan Burn is the problem you were always going to get with a 6 foot seven left back. There's a reason why there aren't too many 6 foot seven left backs around. And Dan Burn has given brilliant service to Newcastle in the time he's been here. But there have been times when he's been exposed against extreme pace. And you put Sven Botman at his best or Fabian Scherer at his best out there, and they're going to be exposed by that pace. It's a difficult situation. For me, Dan Burn is a centre-half playing at left-back who has done a pretty good job for a lot of the time he's played left-back. But at the end of the day, he's still probably a centre-half.
And whatever happens, he will go down as one of Newcastle's most influential players of recent years, probably second only to Kieran Trippier for his importance off the pitch as much as on it.
No, absolutely. I would totally agree with that. And I think it's only over the last few months that people have started to question his place in the team. Last season, he barely put a foot wrong, you know, on the pitch. But yeah, his influence off it as a sort of flag bearer and, you know,
dancer.
They said about that the better. But there is a Geordie core in there, and he's very much part of, you know, front and centre of that. And that, I think that's really important.
Yes, of course. Let's turn to Middlesbrough now. Last week, all three legends and my good self, we all predicted a Middlesbrough win against Blackburn after they'd won three games in a row to revive their playoff bid. It didn't quite work out, which suggests that while Middlesbrough aren't going to get sucked into the mire, they probably are a little bit short of being a genuine playoff contender. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, actually, when you look at that table, I mean, you know, the top end of it is very, very competitive, isn't it? And at one point, it looked like the top two were away, and they've been sort of been dragged back into it. But yeah, you would think Borough are sort of clinging on to the fringes of those playoff places. And in fairness, 3 weeks ago, they didn't look like they were going to be anywhere near. But then you put together that run of wins, and they've dragged themselves right back onto the fringes of it anyway. But yeah, I mean, when you look at the top three, it's probably between the top three now for those two. You wouldn't think. Southampton have games in hand, don't they? So it could be a four-way battle for those top two places. But then, so yeah, you're effectively fighting for two places, and Borough amongst a pack of teams, probably six, seven teams, but at the lower end of that pack. So yeah, you would think if you're not winning games like QPR at home, you're probably going to struggle to force your way into that top six.
That's right, and I see that this week Riley McGree picked up an injury playing for Australia. Now, you know, like Newcastle, Borough have had a lot of injuries and unavailability due to the Asian Cup and the African Cup of Nations. So, you know that although they've had an eventful season, it's certainly not been without some form of trauma.
No. No, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I've been down to other games when they're, you know, but like Sunderland, neither club have really had a seasoned striker available, and that's hurt them at times. I suppose the one thing you would say about Borough was, you know, if you sign Australian players, you know, Newcastle had this in the past with African players, didn't they? If you sign those players, you know that at some point in a season, they are going to be away for a major tournament.
Of course.
I suppose you have to build tolerance into the squad to cope with that.
You do get the feeling, though, that there is that sense of stability at the Riverside right now. Michael Carrick, he clearly loves the job. Steve Gibson clearly respects the job he's doing. There won't be as many departures this summer as there were last summer, with, of course, so many players being on loan. So you do feel that there is a decent platform, and one or two quality signings could make Middlesbrough a real threat next season.
You would certainly hope so. You would certainly hope so. Yeah, there does seem to be the basis of a team there. You know, and certainly there's a method. He's got his method of how he wants the team to play, and I think when it's worked, it's worked really well. So yeah, you would hope there wouldn't be too much upheaval this summer, and that he could sort of enhance his squad rather than rebuild it, as has been so often the case with the recent managerial changes. Yeah.
Now let's turn to Sunderland again. Last week, I was so worried by their form, 6 defeats in a row. I said I would happily settle for a point at home to QPR. That's what the Dooley got, which, you know, it's certainly not a revival, but at least it stops the rot. Yeah, I don't want to go over all ground. I'm on record as saying, you know, as an act of self-harm, Sunderland take the biscuit and get rid of Mowbray. But, you know, Michael Dodds, he has got the respect of the players, but they haven't won a game during this this period of him as caretaker boss. Is it time for them to bring in Neil Warnock?
it's
a half serious question. But yeah. I'm sure Neil Warnock has said he's up for another firefighting role, isn't he, in the short term?
Yeah, no, I mean, dear me, no, that's come out of left field. But yeah, I mean, it's exactly what Borough did, wasn't it, three seasons ago? Yes. And it worked, Now, I think probably Michael Dodds would, I mean, people might consider that unfair on Michael Dodds, that, you know, because he did a particularly good job in his first spell as caretaker, although it was a shorter spell. But yeah, you can't let it go on too long. I mean, what did Neil Warnock have? Eight games, was it, when he came in? And we're at a similar stage of the season, aren't we? So yeah, I mean, I think Sunderland's problem is, as it has been all season, is that there's no regular goal scorer there. They didn't replace Ross Stewart, and that is still hurting them.
That's right.
You know, at this stage.
Yeah. Well, I remember the game against Southampton at home when they won 5-0, and they were outstanding. And at 4-0 up, Hemia was sent through 1-on-1 on the keeper, and he missed. And part of me thinks if that had gone in, that could have been, in hindsight, Sunderland's most decisive moment of the season, because had that gone in, his confidence would have changed overnight. But what the club did, it was almost like they brought in, what was it, 4 strikers, and I suspect the feeling was, oh well, at least one of them has got to be right. And Tony Mowbray gave the impression that while he liked them and he was going to coach them to death to try and improve them, I don't think he had a lot of faith in any of those 4 players.
No, I think that one of the reasons that Tony Mowbray sort of parted company with the club was that he knew or felt, and I would agree with him, that they needed an experienced striker in January. Because, as you say, the 4 young kids have brought in, you know, the 4 younger players have brought in have potential, but none of them was at a stage of scoring 10, 12, 15 goals in a season, which is, you know, the minimum you need really to have a standard chance of getting out. And as you say, some of them have shown Roosen at times has looked like he can cause problems, but hasn't really scored goals. I know he got the equaliser at Borough, but. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you're exactly right. I think Tony Mowbray didn't think any of them were ready for the Championship on a sustained basis. And correct. You would have to say he's probably been proved right.
The hierarchy has come in for a lot of criticism, some justified, some not. But I was glad to hear this week the announcement that there are going to be some improvements to the stadium alike, which, of course, is approaching its... It's approaching its 30th anniversary. They're going to introduce safe standing. They're going to redo the pitch, new floodlights, and 1 or 2 other improvements within the ground itself, which it's good to hear, because it does suggest commitment. It does suggest a vision, and it does suggest that this model isn't just purely focused on bringing in young players. The model has other areas to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's Sunderland get ridiculous crowds for a for a club that spent four years in League One. But the stadium was tired, and it does need more than a lick of paint. So yeah, I mean, it's they're saying it's a multi-million pound investment which will transform the match day experience, and I'm sure it will. But I think you're right, it's indicative of a greater engagement with the club and the fan base and what's required. And we all know about the foot shooting earlier in the season around the derby. It's yes. I think this is, sort of perhaps a recognition that they needed the need to do something for their own fans to improve that matchday experience, as they've said.
So, Damien Spellman, a man who we, you and I know very well, Ian.
Indeed, yes, he's of our vintage, Dave. That's yes. A polite way of putting it.
And to be fair, your next guest I know very well, because I used to work with him at Capital Radio before he came up to the North East. So that's how long back myself and Mick Lowes goes to.
Yes, he's a name that a lot of people up here won't have heard for many years. And when I spoke to him earlier this afternoon ahead of tonight's interview, I asked him, when was it? Was it 2 or 3 years when you stopped commentating in Newcastle? He said, no, it was 2016. I couldn't quite believe it.
Wow.
But, I mean, he really did leave an indelible mark on the region with his, he has this wonderful talent as a commentator to with a blank canvas. He paints the most marvellous pictures. And I'm looking forward to speaking to Mick, who's now based in Newark. But listen, Dave, I mean, the good news for the three legends and for ourselves is next week our predictions can't be totally way out, because by the time the Black and White Red All Over show is on air, Sunderland and Middlesbrough will already have played their games on Good Friday. It's only the Newcastle v West Ham game we can get wrong. But they're important games. Middlesbrough have a tough trip to Southampton, promotion chasing Southampton. Out of sorts, Sunderland, okay, they haven't lost seven in a row, but they're still without a win in seven. They're at Cardiff. How do you see that one going?
It's going to be a tricky one, because Cardiff their last outing, they lost the last game. That was the 2-0 defeat at Swansea. That was the South Wales derby. So I'll claim the usual fifth on that one. That form book, form can go out the window. But other than that, Cardiff, four back-to-back victories before that. So they're in a really good run of form, barring that last game defeat. I think it's going to be tricky for Sunderland. Just the 1 point in the last, seven. I think that's going to be a real, real tough task for Sunderland to come back with anything from Wales.
I agree. And, when I was talking to Damien earlier and I said, is it time for them to bring in Neil Warnock? It was half joke, half serious. But you do wonder, because, once a slide happens, it can go on and on and on. And I don't think they'll pick up anything in Wales either. And, that will see them fall into the bottom half of the table, and then they will need to win one or two games pretty soon to give themselves a bit of breathing space from those fighting relegation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Middlesbrough last week, I guess, was a coupon buster. After three successive wins, we all expected them to beat Blackburn, but another 0-0 draw. Next week, Southampton's a tough place to go to, isn't it? Because they are chasing an automatic top two slot.
They are, and without Foss and Riley McGree, it looks like, because of injuries.
I know, yeah.
So I think that's really, because it's been interesting to note the turn of form for the Borough positively came with both Foss and McGree coming back into the side and Johnny Howson being instrumental. So you've just lost two of those attacking midfield options. Howson obviously sits back a bit. So I think that's going to really rip the heart out of the Borough. Otherwise, I would have fancied them to at least put up a good display at Southampton. Southampton, look, they're in fourth spot, but they're now adrift of those who are fighting it out for the top two. And I think their automatic promotion hopes are just about over. So it's going to be interesting to see what their reaction is to that. But two straight wins for Southampton, back-to-back victories. Obviously, we know about the Sunderland game. They beat Birmingham as well at St Andrews. Birmingham down to 10 men in that game.
Yes.
So it's going to be a real tough ask for the Borough. The best I can hope as a Borough fan is to come away with a point.
Yeah, I mean, Southampton, they have got games in hand over the three sides above them, and if they win them, they would be back in the thick of the race, won't they? They have got a good squad, and let's put it this way, and it's a euphemism for saying I think Middlesbrough will lose, but if they come back with a point, they'll have achieved a good result.
Yeah, got it. I've got it. Yeah. Cool.
But anyway,
quick break.
We'll have a break, and then we'll speak to Michael Lowe.
Black and white and red all over. 3 decades of reporting North East football. Ian Murtagh. The Cubs, the Town
and the Red. Well, every time I have a show, about 15 minutes beforehand, I have a chat with our three legends to tell them what's going to be on the Black and White and Red all over show. And Lee Clark, Darren Williams, Craig Hignett said, who are your guests this week? And when I mentioned Mick Lowe's, all three of them, wow, you're speaking to Mick. Pass on his regards. Pass on our regards to Mick. So, Mick, you know, it's been quite a while since you've been in the region, but you left a pretty good impression on folk.
Well, not so much that I've been not been that often back in the region, Ian. It's more a case of, I was back with a few mates not so long ago. I haven't seen many games at St James's this season. Started first game of the season against Aston Villa. Haven't really seen a game since then. But as I say, have been back a couple of times to see mates. So, it's always great to come back. It's always great to see the city, to see the football club. To see friends. So, and funnily enough, April the 2nd, my birthday, in around about 2 weeks' time, I'm back in for the Everton game that Tuesday night and celebrate my birthday that day as well. So, ironically, I will, having said that I wouldn't have been back for a while, I will be back in about 10 days' time.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of people pleased to see you. Now, I'm going to let you know a little secret, Mick, because I can remember a particular game at the San Siro. It was when Newcastle played Inter Milan. It was a 2-2 draw, of course. And you'd been off air for a little while, and I was sitting in the press box in the row in front of you with the other print journalists, and I can remember listening to you painting the scene about 10-15 minutes before kickoff, when there were about 10,000-12,000 Newcastle fans in the ground. And quite frankly, it was poetry. I'm not trying to make you big-headed, but it was a wonderful scene setter then. And I've remembered that. And I know a few other journalists remember it. As a broadcaster, you took great pride in your prose. You had a reputation for, well, as I say, painting in the canvas, didn't you?
Well, it's very flattering. I'm very grateful to you for those words. But I think it's just like anything in life, Ian. Some people sort of fall into some things. Some people come to them, maybe come to it naturally. I don't know. I never trained to be a journalist. I never trained to be a broadcaster. I had a major league fashion. Passion about football, and sort of fell into broadcasting and got away with it very, very quickly and just kept running with it. And I think you have to be a number. Funnily enough, I saw an interview, a podcast with, of all people, Tom Hanks, not so long ago. And he was talking about acting and what acting needs more than anything. And it sort of needs for you to be, you can't afford to be self-conscious. You cannot care about what people think and what people say. And you have to be very passionate about what you do. And I often say to a lot of people that being a football commentator is a bit like being an actor. You have to put on a show. You have to sort of really
throw your all into it. And I was always quite prepared to do that. As I say, you know, I'm not the most self-conscious person in the world. You know, I'm not easily sort of pleased or disappointed with what happens to me. I just let it go. So, yeah, it's very nice of what you to say, but I was never really conscious of it. I was lucky in so much as I got involved in it very early on and found myself liking it. So that's all it was, really. It was just being right place, right time, and finding somewhere down the line a niche which suited me very nicely.
Mick, one of my recent guests was Guy Mowbray, who, of course, has reached the very top of the profession. He's covered World Cup finals. He'll be heading to Euro 2024 in Germany. But he confessed to me that there is part of him who would love still to be a one-club commentator because you get so much. You share the joy, you share the ecstasy, but you also share the pain. But when achievement happens, you feel it much, much more. And you did have opportunities to move elsewhere, but Newcastle, it got under your skin, didn't it? And it meant something to you reporting on them.
It works both ways, Ian, funnily enough. I mean, I'd worked previously at Capital Radio in London, where I'd be doing Tottenham games, Arsenal games, Crystal Palace games, Millwall games, wherever. We did the World Cup finals in Italy in 1990. But then I decided I was sort of vice president behind President Jonathan Pearce, and I decided I wanted to be the gaffer. And there was a job at the BBC at Newcastle as sports editor. So I decided to go, you know, to the northeast, which was a godsend in the end. And then soon, very quickly, because when I first started, we were split between doing commentaries or being at either Roker or St James's. And then very quickly, we decided that I would permanently be at St James's. And I can see what Guy means, but what I can also say as well is that sometimes, you know, all well and good to get, you know, very good contacts and have very good knowledge on a weekly day basis. Sometimes as well, you can almost feel a little bit, I don't know what the word is, you feel almost as if you're a bit too close to the situation. I remember instances, and I could name plenty of them. For instance, Alan Pardew, who had a good deal of time for and had great respect for and liked as a person.
But me too.
I was probably the only person in the whole of Newcastle upon Tyne who did that.
No, you weren't. No, there were a few of us.
You know, was an absolutely fantastic fella. Just didn't do it at Newcastle. Graham Souness, probably for me the most articulate pundit on TV now, was an absolutely magnificent man to interview, but they hated him at Newcastle most of the time as well. So it's very difficult. You have to find that middle ground between being constructive and hopefully you know, find a middle ground where you try and please everybody, but then again you'll never be able to.
Are you still there? I think we've lost you there.
You were coming back to me at this. I was coming back to me at this end.
Yes, I can hear you now, Mick. Hello. I think we're having difficulties getting in touch.
I can hear you, Ian.
Good stuff. Carry on, Mick. Carry on.
No, I think that was it. I was just talking that you know, sometimes just knowing that one club. Just almost feeling as if you feel like you're almost a staff member when you've been there as long as I've been there, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. So you almost feel as if you're due to lend a hand to the club, which you cannot be as a journalist. You've got to be constructive.
Of course.
And you've got to be impartial as well.
I Because you mentioned your stint with Capital. Now, you had brief spells, of course, covering Sunderland and Middlesbrough when he came up to the region. Now, I can remember a night, quite a famous night for Sunderland Football Club, when they won the fifth round FA Cup replay at Upton Park against West Ham. And we were all staying at the Tower Hotel. And we got back about midnight and had a drink. And suddenly you walk in with Bobby Moore and introduce him to us. And we're drinking with Bobby Moore till about 3 o'clock in the morning. So you certainly had your contacts.
Yeah, I mean that was, I mean, funnily enough, I was the person who actually introduced him to Capital, because we needed a pundit, we needed a co-commentator, and by that time I was quite friendly with his son Dean, who was actually a printer for the Daily Sport of all people, and he just said his dad was kicking around. I mean, this is the 1966 World Cup winning captain, was just kicking his heels. So all of a sudden, I said, look, get him up to Capital. I'll introduce him, see if he fancies doing a bit of radio. And before we knew it, he'd said yes. We'd said obviously yes. And we had a fantastic time together. Obviously went to Italy in 1990. And what a person. What a person. I tell you an interesting story about Bobby Moore and how great a man he is. I remember one season, it would have been the 1991 season, because we went to Portsmouth in the FA Cup tie between Pompey and Tottenham, and Gascoigne was in his absolute pomp. And if you look on YouTube, Portsmouth against Tottenham Hotspur, I think Tottenham won 2-1 and he scored both goals. And one of the goals was beyond belief. And Bobby was knocking about with Gazza. And we got back to the car, because Bobby used to drive in his Jaguar. And his Jaguar had been turned away by, well, it had basically been clamped and then driven away to a pound about half a mile from Fratton Park. And we went back, we walked all the way back to this pound full of cars, including Sir Bobby's Jaguar. Say Sir Bobby, was never Sir Bobby, actually. And he's in the queue waiting for the car. And by this time, of course, everybody who's trying to find their car and got their car that had been clamped and then driven away is immediately going, this is Bobby Moore, this is Bobby Moore. Everybody wanted to talk about Bobby Moore. We then get up the queue, and the guy who's there shelving out £10, £20, £30 off people to give them their cars back. The guy says, Bobby Moore. And he says, yeah. He says, you don't have to pay. He said, these people have all paid. I want to pay. So fantastic. He paid for the car and off we went. But that was the case. You know, that was the guy he was. You know, he was very Keegan-like in so much. He dealt exactly the same with princes as he did paupers. Fantastic. Fantastic guy. Absolutely fantastic.
Well, I can remember working for the Evening Chronicle at the time, and I should have been up at 7 o'clock for the copy taker to file my report the next day. Anyway, thanks to you and Bobby Moore, I slept in, and John Gibson, the sports editor, said, why have you filed the report late? I said, oh, well, I was drinking with England's 1966 World Cup winning captain. He said, that's all right then. So I can remember that story very well. But let's go back to you. Of course, you were brought up a Nottingham Forest fan, weren't you?
As a kid, yeah. I mean, we didn't move to Nottingham until we didn't move to Nottingham until about I think the age of 11. So I watched Forest from about 11 through to about 16. I mean, funnily enough, I started school in Italy. You know, I'd been here, there and everywhere with my dad's job.
Yeah, I can hear you. Carry on.
The Forest thing was, yeah, I mean, I was pre-Clough, you see. So by the time I'd left London to be a student, I missed all the European games. I missed sort of 18, 19, 20, 21 in terms of my age. So I didn't really see an awful lot of it. But no, I started out as Forest and then London. But then, as I say, 25 years with Newcastle, it's almost half my life. So there's only one way that I'm ultimately going to lead towards that way.
Yes, I guess Forrest was a girlfriend for you and Newcastle was a marriage.
Absolutely. I mean, I always say to people, you know, that the Forrest thing was, it was like finding your first girlfriend. But by the time I'd got to Newcastle, she'd gone from girlfriend to wife. And that was it for the rest of my days as a journalist.
And of course, you couldn't have picked a better time to cover Newcastle United. You were there for the entertainers. I think we were there for the promotion season, and then when they finished third and fourth, getting into Europe, then cup finals at the end of the 20th century, and then Europe again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's where in life in general you need an awful lot of luck. And I was very, very fortunate in that while I started radio in Nottingham, I started just covering rugby union, and Nottingham Rugby Club suddenly turned into a proper rugby club, which it had never been previously, and had Rob Andrew and
Rob
Simon
Andrew, Austin, of course, that's Ryan right, Moore, yes.
Gary Reese, yes. And one or two others. I then went to London and was headhunted there, because Capital Radio were then launching their football. And again, that was a compute fluke, really, in many ways. I then arrive and find Bobby Moore, again, Jonathan Pierce, again, very fortunate. I go to Newcastle, again, in 1991, both of the top clubs, both Sunderland and in Newcastle, were in a right state, really, in many ways. And yet, in my first season, Sunderland go to an FA Cup final, and Kevin Keegan arrives at Newcastle. Then we have the great entertainers. And then, of course, we sign the world's most expensive striker. And I have 10 years for Shearer as well. So, I mean, who would have dreamt that? Who would have ever thought that when I was starting with Nottingham Rugby Club in 1985? I mean, within 7 or 8 years, my entire life had turned on its head, you know?
Yes. Can you give the listeners your six lottery numbers for tomorrow, please, Mick?
No, I don't do them, actually.
But, no, I don't either.
As the Everton games and my birthday's close to 10 days away, I'll throw number two in this weekend.
Listen, I mean, you will have commentated on wonderful, wonderful footballers, interviewed some unbelievable characters. Can you just give me some of your favourite people that you interviewed in your time in the North East?
In the North East, the obvious ones in the North East would be Keegan and Shearer. But then again, I mean, I'll give you, and you will know this as well as probably more than listeners will know this. The media in 1991, when I started at the North East, was in a very different, it was a very different business. I mean, you were basically talking about print journalists, radio broadcasters, and TV broadcasters. So as a result, I had on my availability a one-on-one, face-to-face with every manager at Newcastle United for virtually the entire 25 years. And I could spend probably on most weeks, probably 5 to 6 face-to-face, one-on-one, with anywhere between about 5 minutes and 10 minutes. Nowadays, broadcasters will probably get 2 answers and 2 questions, maybe a couple more. Will not get anything one-to-one, and will not get anything face-to-face. Will not be able to talk to people in depth, won't be able to have relationships with people, because nowadays, sadly, you know, you're talking about bloggers, YouTubers, podcasters, internet, broadcast radios, broadcast TVs, left, right and centre. Radio is falling by the wayside, sadly. But there's just too much time for managers to give the amount of time over to the likes of me from sort of 1990 yes. through to about 2010, almost for a generation. So if you're talking about the great names, I mean, can you imagine sitting down as a relatively young man to sit down 5-10 minutes, six times a week to Kevin Keegan, Kenny Dalglish, Rude Hullett, Bobby Robson, Graham Souness, Rafa Benitez? You know, it's mind-boggling. And then you've got players who were, again, prepared to sit face-to-face, one-on-one. So you've got the Shearers, you've got the great Speeds, you've got the Nobby Solanos, you've got the Les yeah. Ferdinand. I mean, it was, I was just checking it today because sometimes I have to pinch myself. You'll mm-hmm. know this as well. Between 1994 and 2007, we were 11 of 13 seasons in Europe.
I know.
11
I know.
Of 13 seasons. We were never away from Europe because of one reason or another. Champion League, UEFA, Intertoto, Cup Winners' Cup, Fair Play, I think, one year. We got a fair That's, play.
Yes, and some of us were fortunate to see Middlesbrough go all the way to UEFA Cup final against Seville in Eindhoven. That was wonderful as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, and I'm not even sure that they can get that. I mean, Razor and John Anderson at the BBC weren't even allowed to do two of the group games at BBC Newcastle because
it's sad,
it was split between Five Live and the BBC, which is terrible in many ways. So,
it is. Money has taken over.
Just so lucky in so many ways.
That's right. Now, when I spoke to you earlier today, Mick, I said, is it 3 or is it 4 years since you left the region? I couldn't believe it. You said it was 8. Now, you've got a magnificent successor in Matthew Raysbeck, AK yeah. Razor. But, can you explain to the listeners what you're doing now?
Well, not an awful lot. Tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to watch Newark and Sherwood against Wisbeach Town in the Northern Premier League One game.
Wonderful. It's non-league day, of course, so it's lovely to hear that. It's non-league day, so it's great to hear that.
Absolutely. I mean, when Kevin Nolan was at Notts County, I used to go and see him for a lot of games. So that mm-hmm. was sort of old Division 4. Nobby was then followed by Neil Cox, who was an assistant manager at Notts County. So I used to go and see games with him and mm-hmm. see him afterwards. So I watched a lot of Notts County for a couple of seasons, which is good, and it's great to see it at that level of football. I've only seen one Forest game since being back here, and that was Arsenal, last game of last season, to see Wendy Taylor, who we all know as the ex-press officer.
Yes, it was lovely seeing her on Boxing Day. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
There are one or two odd connections. I mean, at Notts County, Scholler was at Notts County. Alan Smith was at Notts County.
Yes, it was a fair Newcastle connection.
At Forest, Jack Colback was at Forest for a while. So, it's there's a lot of a lot of acquaintances in football, but you don't have close friends, so to speak. So mm-hmm. everybody knows everybody, but you don't ever really sit down and know them as well as you really would like to know them.
It's been absolutely fantastic listening to you, and I'm sure our listeners are saying, oh, so that's what Mick Lowe's doing now, and I'm sure it will have thrilled them as much as me to hear so many good stories. Finally, you mentioned, Mick, Newcastle. We covered 11 seasons out of 13. Was it 11 out of 13, did he say, in Europe? Will they be
yeah,
in 11 Europe
out
next?
13.
That's
yeah.
right. Will they be in Europe next season? That's a $6 million question the two and Army are asking right now.
What was that again?
I'm saying, will they be in Europe next season? Because that's the question fans will be asking.
If I had to genuinely put my neck on the block, I would say unlikely, Ian. Very much unlikely.
I agree with you.
I have to say, if I'm going to be brutally honest, with 10 games remaining and the way that they are completely spiralling out of control at the moment, I would be actually more content with them make suring that they're finishing somewhere about 8th, 9th and 10th with some level of credibility. I mean, you know, we all know the phrases of last season about overachievement and really how surprised we were with that fourth finish. You know, it was a bit Alan Pardew in fifth and getting back to Europe, etc. But I think this time around, there are serious problems at this minute in time. I have no doubt that Eddie Howe is capable. My only question, if we want to be serious about this, is that having known so much about that football club for 25 years and having known pretty much who I knew was in charge, who I knew was likely to do.
Yes.
I just don't know what's Riyadh and what PIF are going to ultimately do with this football club. And I don't think a lot of people don't know that either.
Couldn't agree more.
Until we really get our heads around that, then we'll never really know what the long-term plan is for Newcastle United, whether it means a change of managership, a change of stadia. We just don't know, because nobody knows what's going to happen with what's happening at Riyadh.
You've nailed it yet again, Mick. Absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much. The Reds, the tune and the car.